Do either of you know how many streaming subscriptions you have?
That is my wife's domain.
HBO Now still exists, but they're going to be migrating people to HBO Max.
Now that I fully understand this, I'm not going to subscribe.
How do you even know? Because that's not your decision.
It might just start showing up on the bill.
You may already be subscribed. Hello, welcome to GeekWire. I'm GeekWire editor Todd Bishop.
I'm GeekWire civic editor Monica Nicholsberg.
And I'm GeekWire co-founder John Cook.
We're coming to you from GeekWire in Seattle, where we get to report each day on what's happening around us in technology, science, and innovation. What happens here matters everywhere. And every week on this show, we get to talk about some of the biggest and most interesting stories we've been covering. Coming up this week, Amazon and its critics wage a PR war at the company's first virtual annual meeting. HBO Max, the new streaming service engineered in Seattle, launches without support from its neighbor, Amazon. We'll tell you the backstory. And some iconic entertainment and tech destinations in Seattle, Cinerama and the Living Computers Museum, suddenly face an uncertain future and potential demise. We'll explain why. All right, let's jump into our first story. Monica, you and I both covered Amazon's annual meeting this past week. This event is usually a circus in person, and online this year, it struck me it was really a public relations war.
It was a totally different thing. For one thing, I was allowed to attend this year. Normally, I'm outside with the protesters because they've had really strict rules about who can go inside the meeting. But this time, I got to actually listen in, and it was fascinating.
We have some sound that gives you a sense for the dueling positions and perspectives that emerged. First, this is from a Amazon video that played at the beginning of the annual meeting of shareholders, followed by a voice from an employee who was fired for speaking out and, according to Amazon, violating company policies against communicating externally.
When you walk into an Amazon fulfillment center, it's like walking into the chocolate factory and you want a golden ticket. It's an amazing feeling.
I and eight others were recently fired, and VP Tim Bray resigned, citing a vein of toxicity that runs through the company.
That was activist and former Amazon employee Marin Costa. What struck you about the two different viewpoints that were presented here?
Well, there are a lot of things about today that feel kind of Orwellian, and this PR, or you might even say propaganda war between Amazon and its critics that was on display at this meeting certainly falls into that category. I was just struck by the dueling visions because they really represent the dichotomy that Amazon faces right now. On the one hand, it's a lifeline to people who are afraid to leave their homes. And on the other, it has this growing problem of COVID-19 cases in its warehouses that's getting a ton of criticism, a ton of attention. And while we might have seen that at a normal Amazon meeting with some protesters outside, this time there was a much bigger platform for Amazon critics to really get their message out there, particularly Marin Costa, who has been active with the employee activist group Amazon Employees for Climate Justice. They've seen their awareness really take off, I think, since the pandemic started.
What strikes me is that the true purpose of a shareholder meeting like this is for a company to report to its shareholders and be held accountable by them. And Amazon has reached the point where its stakeholders are everybody in the world. And so its meeting, in many of these cases, has become not about the company, but about the environment, society, diversity, all sorts of issues that are tangential and certainly Amazon impacts in an outsized way. But the discussion of the company's actual business, I mean, call me old fashioned, but like it was hardly even there.
It was not the central focus. It seemed like there was a lot more attention on the various shareholder resolutions that were submitted asking Amazon to change its ways. Like you mentioned, there were some that focused on the environment and sustainability, some that focused on workplace discrimination and harassment. The company's facial recognition software, that's always a lightning rod, also came up. But I don't even particularly remember the financial details.
It was as if 2019 was kind of just not relevant to many of the discussions that took place at the meeting. I will say that one thing I did miss was the freewheeling nature of the Q&A that typically happens at these meetings. My favorite scene last year was when one of the shareholders stood up and expressed her frustration trying to return a product that she had bought on Amazon and asked Jeff Bezos to personally take her return. Those kinds of dynamics, those kinds of fun, impromptu things that actually do shed a light on the company and its operations, they were nowhere to be seen. It was a really stilted Q&A. And frankly, I think it was almost entirely scripted, even though they said they were taking submissions from actual shareholders on the meeting. Maybe they were, but it came off as if it was scripted. In the past, when this meeting was held in person, it was so closed off. You had to show up in Seattle, be a shareholder, and get into that room. They did not broadcast this anywhere. They didn't play the stream afterward. And because of that, it was kind of this weird, insular event. And I think they were in part somewhat reluctant to air all of these criticisms and these issues in a way that people around the world could see them and hear them. But this year, it was just all out in the open because the meeting went virtual as a result of the lockdowns and the restrictions on travel and public gatherings because of COVID-19. Monica, in the end, who do you think won here? Not the argument, but perhaps the war. Was there one side that had a better advantage, Amazon or its critics, in this new format?
I don't know that one side had an advantage over the other. And I think it kind of depends on your scorecard. I always go back to this, but if you're measuring based on Amazon's customer base, sales, revenue, then they tend to always win. But if you're measuring based on who's making the most noise, then I think Amazon's critics are definitely getting the upper hand in the PR war.
Another story that came out this past week that I would point you to, we found in Amazon's job postings indications that they're pivoting part of their Lab 126 team. This is the unit that makes the Kindle and the Echo and other Amazon hardware to the COVID-19 testing effort. This really, to me, underscored something you said a couple weeks ago, John, which is that Jeff Bezos is looking at this as an opportunity to redirect their engineering resources and spend more shareholder money on this big kind of bet.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting to hear technological people, entrepreneurial people talk about this crisis right now. And you heard this in the webinar we hosted earlier this week that featured Rich Barton, the co-founder and CEO of Zillow as well. And it's this really interesting balance of saying you're being opportunistic to try to take advantage of a real business situation here. But Rich's point, and I think what Jeff Bezos's point was, is there is tremendous disruption happening here in a very, very short period of time. And usually that's a good thing for visionaries and people that think in entrepreneurial mindsets, that they can find those crevices in which to operate and expand and grow very large businesses. And I absolutely think that's what Bezos is doing. I mean, Bezos has been doing that for years, but certainly in this environment, I think there's more opportunity to innovate, create, disrupt existing systems. And I think we're going to see more of it from companies like Amazon.
Well, speaking of disruption, do you have room for one more streaming service in your life? We're going to get into that coming up next. You're listening to GeekWire. Welcome back. It's Todd Bishop with Monica Nicholsberg and John Cook. You're listening to GeekWire. Do either of you know how many streaming subscriptions you have? I assume both of you subscribe to Netflix.
That is my wife's domain, but I would say normally almost every single one, although we do not have Disney Plus. Not yet, at least. I'm sure it's being talked about.
Yeah, I could sit here and count them, but it probably wouldn't make for very good radio. So I'll just say I'm kind of in the same boat as John.
HBO says that the average person out there is willing to pay for up to 6 services. And that's the point where it starts to get more expensive than cable TV. HBO this past week launched HBO Max, which is their new subscription service that essentially replaces HBO Now, which was their prior standalone subscription service. But the interesting thing to me about this was Amazon Fire TV support and Roku support were both missing at launch. They had iOS, Android, Mac, Windows, every platform except for the 2 most popular streaming platforms. If you look at devices that are actually on TVs and streaming in the living room, Fire TV and Roku. And Amazon was really clear about what's going on here. They are upset. They're pissed at HBO because HBO is not offering this new HBO Max service to people who subscribe to HBO through Amazon Prime channels. And this gets back to this kind of petty thing that often happens between tech companies when they're both competitors and partners. And they all like to say, oh, no, we get to separate those two things. We're not really rivals. We cooperate on the platform. I mean, BS. I mean, look at this stuff that happens all the time. And I think it's just interesting how it plays out at this big picture corporate level.
Yeah, it didn't feel very collaborative when it took years for an Amazon app to come to my Apple TV.
The other interesting thing that's going on here behind the scenes is that HBO has a very significant engineering center in Seattle. In fact, it's just a few blocks from Amazon's headquarters. And HBO has been hiring like crazy. They were just acquired by AT&T through Warner Media. So they have quite a bit of resources to recruit. And I looked at the LinkedIn profiles for some of the top engineers and engineering managers and leaders at the HBO office. And there had to be 5, 6, 7, 8 high-ranking engineers who are at HBO in Seattle who just left Amazon within 6 months to a year. So clearly there's a lot of competitive dynamic happening between these two companies, not just at the tech and streaming level, but at the recruiting level.
So on HBO Max, if you have Comcast or a cable system and you subscribe to HBO, you're getting all of the content, I presume, that you would get through HBO Max because you're a subscriber to the service through a cable service. Or there's new content. There's additional content.
Yes. So in addition to the core HBO content, HBO Max includes a bunch of acquired content that HBO went out and got. Examples include Friends. So they have the entire library of Friends episodes.
Not going to do it.
Who doesn't want that?
Not going to do it.
It's not going to sell you on it.
Never got into it. Not going to start now. So that's good to know. So there is a rationale for somebody who already is subscribing to HBO through their cable platform to potentially pay another $15 a month for this service.
That's right. And the other issue there is that that fee, that monthly fee, is quite a bit higher than many other services that have launched recently or that have been around in the past charge. They're trying to compare it in part to Netflix in terms of the quantity and quality of content. But yeah, absolutely right.
And just so I'm clear here again, this is replacing HBO Now.
That's right.
So there no longer is HBO Now.
Essentially, HBO Now still exists, but they're going to be migrating people to HBO Max. So it's super confusing.
Well, there's also HBO Go.
Right. HBO Go is what you typically get through an existing cable or satellite TV subscription. So it's essentially your cable or satellite HBO subscription, but portable.
Now that I fully understand this, I'm going to tell you, I'm not going to subscribe.
How do you even know? Because that's not your decision.
Well, that is true. It might just start showing up on the bill.
I was going to say, you may already be subscribed.
I hope not. I have so much content to watch that's like, I can't get through even on the three channels I'm a part of, or, you know, three streaming services. It's just crazy.
Which ones do you both find yourself watching most?
I do watch HBO probably the most.
I watch Netflix the most.
It'll be interesting to see how it plays. I mean, there are a lot of these services.
All right. So that is the new service from HBO, HBO Max. We will link to all of our coverage on GeekWire for more about that and for the explainer about the difference between Go, Now, and Max. Coming up next, two longtime Seattle institutions are under threat. We'll explain what they are and why it matters. Next up on GeekWire. Welcome back. It's Todd Bishop with John Cook and Monica Nicholsberg. John, one of my favorite places in Seattle is the Living Computers Museum and Labs. This is the place where Paul Allen, the late Microsoft co-founder, assembled with his team essentially the entire computer revolution dating back to mainframes. And the cool thing about it is they actually make them work. The Living in their name is literal. I loved this place because you got to like literally put your hands onto some of the computers that inspired Bill Gates, Steve Jobs, and Paul Allen. This past week, Vulcan, the holding company that is run by Paul Allen's sister, Jody, announced that they are closing a couple of their internal divisions, and both the Living Computers Museum and Lab and also the Cinerama, the longtime theater with the unusual format, the widescreen format possibilities there, it could be closing. Both of these could be closing in the future. And John, you came up with an interesting idea to salvage at least one of these institutions.
We'll see if it plays out. First off, these are pretty iconic institutions in the Seattle area. When you think about film here in the Northwest. You obviously think of Cinerama, which has had such a great history here back to the early 1960s. And the Living Computers Museum, as you said, Todd, it's not as well known, but a great institution that kind of chronicles the history of the computing revolution, as you said. And so there are great icons here. And the idea, as I floated, was for those who know Seattle, Cinerama is located really in the heart of Amazonville, right next to many of their new buildings that they've constructed in downtown Seattle. And so I floated the concept that maybe Amazon should step up and purchase Cinerama, not only for the history and the PR and the community engagement that would come from that, but I actually think there's a business case that could be made that they would maybe want to have that theater as an option for them, both for employee gatherings, but also perhaps for showcasing some of that original content at an actual movie theater. There've also been rumors recently about Amazon actually eyeing a movie theater chain, AMC. So I think it makes a lot of sense. I don't know if politically Amazon could pull it off, which speaks to the challenge that is going on in Seattle right now. You would think it could be a relatively simple thing for Amazon to say, yeah, we're going to step up and help support our community. We're going to save this great historical cultural icon, and we're going to really work hard with the community to make it work. I actually, given how polarized people are as it relates to Amazon in Seattle, I actually don't know if it's politically possible. And if Amazon even wants to try to venture into this situation. And so I'm left with this thing. I was kind of thinking about this as I was writing the column. In many ways, Cinerama and Amazon's relation to it is almost a litmus test for what its plan is for downtown Seattle. Is it going to invest in its community? Is it going to participate? Is it going to try to engage, try to do some new things as we try to come out of the COVID pandemic? Or are they just going to, as they've kind of been doing, backing out to some degree, investing in Bellevue, investing in Northern Virginia, spreading their workforce wider, and letting kind of downtown Seattle go its own way? So I do kind of see it as a marker here to see how Amazon responds to this.
That is so unfortunate when you think about that, because there was a time in this city when people were looking to Paul Allen as the savior for everything. And they would basically say, well, maybe Paul Allen could buy that and bring it back. And Cinerama was one example. I think if Amazon were to step up, and by the way, this is pure conjecture, it makes logical sense, but there's no indication that they're even considering or have been approached about this. But if they were to step up and be told by the community or the city council that they shouldn't own this or they shouldn't save it, that's crazy. That's totally crazy. People in communities around the country, around the world, would love to have somebody in their midst who would step up and do something like this. And it just speaks to how polarizing Amazon is and how cold they can be. And it's a very dysfunctional relationship if that's the reality.
Well, I think that you have a point, but if you consider it from the other perspective, that this company already owns so much. It basically invented a neighborhood in Seattle where it's headquartered, and it has kind of a colonial approach to business. You know, it likes to take over whole industries and spread into them. And I can just see if they were to buy Cinerama, this icon of Seattle, the tweets coming out like, well, they might as well just buy all of Seattle and we'll all live in our Amazon Prime houses and drive our Prime cars. You know, it's because of the way that they go about things that doesn't really feel always that much like a collaborative member of the community. It feels more like an overlord to some folks.
I do think it's sad. And I think that was what I was trying to get to in the column, was like this idea, like, okay, come on, we're living in this extraordinary time. This is an icon. It's important to so many people who've lived in Seattle for many years. Can we not find some common ground to do something good together as a community with the business community, in this case, Amazon or whoever would step up, representing the business community, the business community interests participating, nonprofits participating, and community members benefiting? If we can't get something as basic done as this, it truly is a litmus test. It's ridiculous. It is ridiculous. And I'm very frustrated with the lack especially as we're going to try to move out and recover from COVID, like we're going to have to all figure out how to work together and solve problems. And money is a component of solving a problem. And having those business interests is important. I agree with some of the sentiment that, you know, you don't want Amazon owning everything, but I think people will forget that, gosh, it was a billionaire to begin with who saved this thing anyway, that people still really like having around.
We should also mention that some of this is more about the public perception than the reality on the ground. While there are aspects of Amazon's response to the COVID-19 crisis that certainly warrant a robust debate, they have implemented some programs to provide relief to, like, for example, the small businesses around their campus in downtown Seattle, the restaurants that rely on office worker foot traffic. They are trying to help those businesses out, and they opened up their Mary's Place homeless shelter amid all of this.
Agreed. And beyond that, Monica, it's not only the philanthropic things you're doing, which you're citing, but frankly, when we're going back to earlier in the discussion, this idea that they're going to invest $4 billion in innovation around COVID, I'm glad a company has decided that they want to spend that much money on something like this. And I have greater faith that a company that is truly innovative and entrepreneurial can carry something like that forward versus some sort of federal government response to the situation we're in. So
at the same time, they have expired their hazard pay that they're paying for workers who are compelled to be there. They're letting go of their unlimited unpaid time off policy. And there are certainly risks to relying on private funding to deal with a crisis like this, because, you know, the only reason that Amazon even can do all of that is because they happen to be the rare company that's doing well financially during this crisis. But that is not a reliable revenue source.
I personally think that it would be cool to see what they could do using that as a prototype for a new generation of movie theaters, taking into account perhaps the entire COVID situation. That theater, the Cinerama, is really amazing after a renovation they did maybe 5, 6, 7 years ago. I know it's still being or was under renovation again, but it's a really great theater. And, you know, plus two words. Chocolate popcorn.
You know, it is a really special place. I think it's near and dear to a lot of our hearts. And it's one of those things that if it can't survive this, we'll definitely feel it deeply.
Which is another part of this story. Why in the world would Vulcan come out with this statement? Vulcan being the company that runs Paul Allen's estate. Why would they do this? They have billions of dollars still in the bank. I assume, Todd, correct me if I'm wrong, they still have probably some shares of Microsoft that they own, which has been doing extraordinarily well. What's going on? Talk about the PR fumble here. You're not in the middle of a pandemic. You put something out like this? I just don't get it. I really don't understand it.
No, I think it was calculated. Couple things. When Paul Allen passed away, we talked about this. His interests were so far flung that it was inevitable that some of these more fanciful projects would go away. Now, I think that you could look at this as using the pandemic as a cover to do what they plan to do anyway. Perhaps, though, they were trying to stir up some interest, some grassroots or corporate interest in acquiring either of these facilities. So I don't know. I think in some ways it actually makes a lot of sense that they would come out with this. And ultimately, if they both do close, they could just say, hey, it was a pandemic. We had to close them.
Yeah, I guess. I guess at some point, though, I would think, and I guess people have to run the estate the way they're going to run it, and they're going to have to manage it the way they see fit. But if you've created institutions in a community and in a city, it seems to me there's a responsibility to those that participate in those to try to keep it going. I think about, you know, we spent as a team a lot of time in Pittsburgh and kind of the legacy of the Steel Barons in Pittsburgh. And like the money is still flowing in that community as a result. I mean, they endowed many of these things for hundreds of years. That's keeping the lights on for many of those cultural activities and institutions that still exist there. And so I don't know, it just seems kind of short-sighted and bad timing. And if there are things that are there and there's money to support it, it just seems strange to pull the plug on it. Now, I guess I do understand, yeah, if you got three mega yachts, maybe you don't need all three of those anymore. That makes sense to me. But stuff that's ingrained in the community, I think there's a different measuring stick for that.
Bottom line, I would be sad if Cinerama went away. I would be heartbroken if all of the work that that team at Living Computers Museum put into restoring those machines was somehow piecemealed away. I mean, that place is amazing. So I hope it sticks around. All right, well, we will link to John's column in the show notes on GeekWire, in addition to everything else that we discussed. Our podcast producer is Kurt Milton. Our theme music is by Daniel L.K. Caldwell. To see all of GeekWire's coverage of science, tech, business, and more, go to geekwire.com. And be sure to sign up for our daily email newsletter to catch all of our headlines. Until next time, I'm Todd Bishop.
I'm Monica Nicholsberg.
And I'm John Cook.
Thanks for listening to GeekWire.